I was reading that the folklorist John Jacob Niles was doing research into English ballads, and he had discovered that much of the tradition had been wiped away in England, many of the origins and what they actually sounded like and what they said. But he discovered that in the isolated area of the Appalachian Mountains, people were still using some of the old English dialects and singing the old, old English ballads. It was almost like they were caught in a time warp.
Well, yes, I think that's wonderful. I find that very interesting. And, of course, Americans use expressions that have not been used in Britain for 300 or 400 years. I mean, you still talk about a cupboard as a closet. And we talked about closets once, and we've now turned them all into cupboards. Well, I think closet is a much nicer word. But that's partly what I mean, because you may say that there are isolated pockets of Americans and they have different ways of living. But it's the culture is known to all Americans, and the speech patterns. And I think the big mistake that a British fiction writer makes is by trying to create American speech, and just as Americans make the same mistake trying to create British speech. We can't do it unless we have lived in each other's countries, I think. I mean, I have lived here for 3 months, and that's the longest, and that isn't long enough. However observant you are, and I think I have a good ear for speech, I know that if anything I did like that would be just a joke. It would be laughable, and quite deservedly, you know, Americans would laugh.
I noticed in reading Going Wrong, it's a wonderful book, that you use all the standard British idioms and expressions and descriptions. You didn't change them for Americans. I can't remember off the top of my head. Oh, well, things like car park instead of parking lot. That was one that comes to mind. But we understand them. I mean, particularly in the context of a sentence. There was never any pressure on you from the American publisher to change these British words, was there?
There used to be long ago when I've had every one of my books published in the United States. And when I was first writing, there was a little pressure. But really, there's never been very much. I think that one should never underrate one's readers. And as you said, Americans understand. They know what a car park is just as much as I know what a parking lot is. And to try and change that, you get a very strange kind of fiction if you do that, because you never do it right. You just change a few words, and the effect on your readers will be that they'll think, well, what is this woman doing? It's not American. It's not British either. It's some sort of mid-Atlantic jumble. You don't want that.
That's right, and you've set the story in London. I mean, it's ridiculous to if I were to set a story in London, I would have to be there, and it would have to be an American in London.
Oh, exactly. The only time I've ever done it the other way, in my Inspector Wexford detective stories, Wexford, you saw what happened in California through Wexford's eyes. Just as when he went to China, you saw what happened in China through Wexford's eyes. To try and do it as a native of the place, that's what's so impossible.
Did you read Stars and Bars, by the way?
Yes, and I enjoyed it very much. I enjoyed it. But how accurate he was, I don't know.
Well,
I can't say you can.
He created, obviously, he created stereotypes of Americans, but the book was a buffoon. I mean, it was supposed to be a comic novel, so I accepted that, and his characterization of Southerners. In fact, the British have a very unfair stereotype of Americans, and they make fun of us on British television and so forth. But at the same time, Americans have a stereotype of Britons. The Colonel Blimp, for example, is a stereotypical Briton, which isn't really true, and he may have been at one time. Or the proper English butler is a stereotype. It's not true.
Yes, I think the British have a stereotype American academic that you're always coming across in British fiction set in America. And I can't remember if that happens in Stars and Bars, but it certainly does in other people's fiction. And there is this this jokey American university, which is full of jokey American types. And they are types, they're stereotypes. I think it's a bit tiresome. And I imagine the Americans do it the other way with us. But perhaps nobody takes it very seriously.
Well, let's talk about your latest book. This is something like your 30th novel, isn't it?
I'm afraid it's more than that.
Confess.
It's my 41st. But that does include collections of short stories.
Well, you have a remarkable track record, and this was really an interesting book because a mystery almost always contains a murder, and this does, in fact, have a murder, but it creeps up on you in a way that you don't expect. It's interesting that you build the suspense because you create all of these corners, and every time I turned a corner, I expected something to happen, and then Guy.
He's a sort of anti-hero, really.
Yeah, like an anti-hero. He pulls back. In a way, I had a real affection for Guy. Tell me how Going Wrong came about.
Well, it's one of my books that really developed itself. Sometimes I have very strong ideas, two strong ideas which I put together. But in this case, really, the idea I had was of a young man who had reached a point in a relationship with a girl of simply taking her out to lunch once a week. Lunch being a sort of innocuous thing. You know, you take somebody out to dinner, and there you've got to think about what you're going to do after dinner. But after lunch, everybody goes back to work or off to what they're doing in the afternoons. And it seemed to me such an innocuous thing, and what could I do with this idea? He takes her out to lunch every Saturday because she is trying, apparently, to end this relationship, and this is the way to phase it out. Once I had that idea, I began to think of my characters, and I began to think of what kind of person it would be that would do that. It also had to be the kind of person that could afford to take a girl out to lunch in expensive places every Saturday and wish to give her everything, to take her out to dinner every night and to give her somewhere wonderful to live and so on. And from there, the rest came to me.
Why did Guy have this obsession? Because you make it clear, and he admits too, that she's completely different from him. She is kind of an intellectual hippie type. The Celeste, the young woman with whom he has another relationship, is much more his type and is definitely in love with him. And yet he is blinded by this other girl. How do you suppose this happened?
Well, isn't it true that people are like that? That they don't know themselves. They deceive themselves about their own feelings and also deceive themselves about the feelings other people have for them, especially if they want something very much. Well, Guy very much wants this girl to feel about him as she apparently once did. He wants it back and he wants it forever. It would be much, much more suitable for him, and he would be much happier if he really did settle down with Celeste, who loves him, who is perfectly suited to him, and everything in common with him, but he doesn't want that. He wants what he can't have, as so many people do.
Tell me about it. That's absolutely correct. He also has a relatively high degree of paranoia, doesn't he? Tell me about that.
Yes, he does, and I think that that comes from the kind of background. He's come from a very poor background in West London. He has been a badly neglected child, and in a way he's risen above this. He's risen above in a criminal way by being a drug dealer and a sort of minor gangster, and he's made a lot of money. But I think when I was working it out, I thought, well, that kind of background and childhood was at the least likely to lead to paranoia. A lot of nasty things have happened to him, and he's risen above them, really. He's been, was a deprived child who managed to make his way by living off the street, really.
Guy never quite breaks his criminal ties, though, does he?
I think that he's the kind of person who is surrounded, his life, his milieu, is a milieu of clubs and racetracks and mildly criminal things, and that's all he knows. He'll never get beyond that. That is the way. You can't imagine him really having a totally legitimate way of making money.
In the story, Guy arranges to hire a hit man to kill the people he thinks are corrupting the girl he wants so badly. But each time he realizes, no, that person isn't responsible, and he tries to call off the hit. Of course, this backfires on him at the end. I won't give away the ending because that's what the entire novel builds to. But you did pull the rug out from under us at the end. I thought when I got to the end, it was going to have a happy ending, and he was going to wind up with Celeste, and everything was going to be fine, and then zip. But that's the craft. That's what you're here for, isn't it? Really, to to give us surprises.
I like to think I'm also here to give character and an insight into people's psychological makeup. But it isn't the essence, really, of my books that there should be a surprise and perhaps a twist as well. People want it. And, of course, I like it myself, you see. I don't think I really write anything ever that I don't want to write or write it in a way that I wouldn't myself enjoy.
Have you heard some of these feminists, especially those here in the United States, who say that a man cannot write from a woman's point of view and a woman cannot write from a man's point of view? This book would tend to dispute that contention.
I know what they say, and I think there may be some truth in it. But you see, one doesn't know oneself. One can only try to write from a man's point of view. I think I can. I don't know. I'm a woman. I think perhaps, I certainly know more how women feel. But it's a challenge to try and write as the opposite sex. I've done both. Perhaps I tend to write more from a man's point of view because I do like the challenge of doing that, trying to put myself in a man's position, in a man's shoes.
You've been surrounded by men all your life. You should have no problem. I don't know another man's point of view, really. I don't think there is a unique point of view among men. I mean, I had drinks with a friend, a male friend of mine, last night, and his point of view about life and sex and death, they're different from mine. If I were to write a story about him, I would have to imagine it, really. You know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying, because I agree with you, because I think that in many ways, men and women are much closer than many people allow. I mean, I think emotionally we are a lot closer than, and intellectually a lot closer than people allow. If it were not so, it would be quite impossible for people to write from the other point of view, and we know it's not, simply because readers have been deceived anyway. I mean, I'm deceiving nobody. They all know I'm a woman. Most people today know the sex of a writer, but it wasn't always so. And certainly in the 19th century, there were lots of people who were writing, giving themselves male pseudonyms because they would not otherwise have been published, and presumably readers believed they were men. So it can be done.
Well, in fact, your outstanding hero, Chief Inspector Reginald Wexford, well, obviously he's a male, and you have another hero, solves crimes with him, yeah, he's a deputy inspector, right?
Burden,
John,
yes.
John Burden. Tell me about how these characters have appeared in the bulk of your mysteries, haven't they?
No. Oh, no, they haven't.
About 13 or 14?
There are 14 of them. And most of them were written fairly early on. I mean, I still do write them, and I'm about to write another one now. Tell you about them.
I think this
them.
Was your well, this was your last Wexford, right?
No. The Veiled One was the last Wexford.
Well, I don't think I have that one.
And that was about 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I'm writing another one because he's very popular. He's very popular with male readers because I think they identify with him. I mean, he's a big, strong man. But he's also a sensitive man, and he's a thoughtful man. He's by no means a great, big, macho, toughy. But he's big and strong, and he has a good relationship with his wife. And he appears to be attractive to women, but not very overtly so. He has a sort of paternal way with him. He has his daughters that he loves very much, and there's a very strong relationship. And I think men identify with him, and women, well, I know that women fall in love with him, which is rather strange because, of course, he is not real. But since he's been on British television a lot, that happens even more. And I get a lot of letters from women who tell me that they're very sort of thinly veiled beliefs that he exists.
Tell me about Burden.
Burden is very different from Wexford because Wexford is very liberal and open-minded and unshockable. And Burden is rather narrow and conservative and a bit prim, less so since his second marriage, I think. And so they are foils for each other. And that makes it interesting to write about, though not as interesting as I hope it is for the reader, because any writer with a series character inevitably gets tired of them. You want new characters to play with, not somebody you know as well as I know Wexford.
How do Wexford and Burden interact when they solve crime?
Well, not, I suppose, in a way in which real policemen would. Real police work is a matter of forensic science today. They interact in the way Victorian policemen did by it's all cerebral and conversation, really. And I like that, and I think readers like it. I'm not claiming to present real crime, real detection. I'm writing fiction about the way people perhaps think it is or would like it to be. And it's almost a fantasy.
That's, people like mysteries a lot because of that, isn't that true? You know, there is something nice about a mystery in that all of the ends, if it's a well-done mystery, seem to be tied up. Where in real life, if there's a terrible crime in real life, sometimes it can't be solved and it baffles us and we don't understand it. But in a mystery, at the end, we kind of understand what happened and somehow good will out. Is that correct?
It probably is for the detective stories, but not for my others. And I think that's why I write my others, because I always, nearly always, leave something open. I mean, at the end of Going Wrong, you don't really know quite what's going to happen. And in some of my books, that's even stronger, that there is simply a very big question left for the reader to decide about. It makes some people very angry, and some people find it satisfying because it's more like life. But people do write to me and say, I couldn't bear the way you... I want to know the answer. And of course, I don't always know it myself. But the detective stories, yes, every end will be tied, and everything restored to order and tidiness, even to the extent of the weather changing so that if the rain goes away and the sun comes up.
So the detective story represents more of escapism, I guess.
Yes, I think it does. It does, in my eyes. That's how I see it, as escape, as you begin with some act of chaos, and then there's a kind of unraveling of strings, and at the end they're all neatly unraveled, tied up, and that's the end of it, and it's satisfying.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about... before I go on, you have Barbara Vine. That's another name for Ruth Rendell. Tell me about that.
The Barbara Vine novels are different again. I had an idea for a novel which I've been working on for years, and when I finally worked it out, I realized it was going to be so different from what I'd done before. I thought I should warn my readers to expect something else, which I did by taking a pseudonym, but not by concealing my true identity. That was the first of the Barbara Vines, and it seemed to work quite well. And there have been three more, and I've just finished another one.
Now, how do those books differ from your other books? For example, the Going Wrong book.
Well,
how would the Barbara Vine book differ?
Going Wrong, some critics said, was very much like a vine, but I don't think so, really. There's not much criminal activity in a vine. Not at all in a straightforward way. I don't think anybody in a vine would use a hitman in the way I do in Going Wrong. They're also sometimes in the first person. They're perhaps a little more from a sort of feminine point of view. But not always. I have a very different feeling about them. I think they're a bit deeper and more searching. Perhaps a bit longer.
You know, one thing that marked... your work, you always tell, every time a character would appear, you would have an elaborate description of the clothing. It was really nice. And you could really picture the person that way, and almost the way that person was. And there's a companion to that, too, because every time they would sit down for dinner, you would describe the food. This is a very conscious attempt on your part. Is that not correct, to describe exactly what happens? Most people kind of slough this off. You know, a man appears and you don't really see the clothing unless it's really germane to the story.
I only did this particularly in Going Wrong because you see the whole narrative through Guy, and Guy is passionately interested in clothes, in sort of accessories of life, in scent and makeup on women, and he's also very interested in food and drink and interior decoration. That's why you see so much of it in this book. I don't think you do in my books often. You don't, really. And I have been told I have been asked, why don't you ever describe clothes? So it's especially because a guy himself is very conscious of these things.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about yourself. You were born in England.
Yes, I was born in London.
What kind of family did you grow up in? Literary household?
My parents were both teachers. My father was English and my mother was Swedish.
Books in the house, obviously. What in your childhood might have pointed your direction as a writer as you matured?
I don't know, because I didn't think of being one. I mean, I really didn't write much until I was certainly in my 20s. And I don't really know what made me begin. Just reading a lot, I think, and thinking, well, I perhaps could do this, such as write a short story, which is how I began, and wrote a lot of short stories, which I sent to magazines, who rejected them all. Then, having written short stories, I thought, well, now I want to write something longer. It seemed to me an incredible thing to write something as long as a novel then. And yet I did it. And in fact, I wrote several novels, but they were, well, very much mainstream stuff. And I wrote one, which I did send to a publisher at last. They rejected it and asked me if I had done anything else. And what I had done, for fun, really, to see if I could, was the first Chief Inspector Wexford, which they published.
And you wrote that for fun?
Yes. I wrote it to see if I could do it, because I had read a lot of detective fiction. I don't read it anymore, really, except some very, very good people like P.D. James and Elmore Leonard. He doesn't really write detective fiction, but he writes, I don't know what you'd call it, crime. But I don't really read anybody else anymore. But I did then. I read a lot of Agatha Christie and Dorothy Sayers and all those people. And I wanted to know if I could do it too. And I wrote, and they took it. They wanted a lot of work done to it. They wanted it rewritten and... But I did it, and it was published.
And what was the name of that first story?
It's called From Dune with Death. And my piece of very good fortune was that it was published here in America.
What year was that?
That was 1964. It was there was an editor from an American publishing house happened to be in London, and somebody gave her a copy of the book or a proof or something. And she read it, and... And it was published here. And, of course, that was a piece of good fortune because it was just something great to have a book published here.
Who was the editor?
It was a woman called Isabel Taylor who was working for Doubleday at the time.
Doubleday has a reputation for publishing mysteries, as St. Martin's Press, your new publisher here. Oh, the Mysterious Press has been doing a wonderful job.
I've got a lot of publishers here because I have a different publisher for Barbara Vine. And I've had different publishers in the past, and sort of isolated publishers for a single book and so on. But all my books have been published here, which is very gratifying to
me. You have an enormous readership in the United States, probably larger than it is in England.
Oh, no.
No, it's not?
Well, in proportion, of course. Yeah. In England I have an enormous readership. And I'm terribly well-known because of the television, you see. And that makes you very famous.
Well, Wexford has been on, we have the series Masterpiece Theatre, right?
No. It's only on A&E here.
Well, I know I passed it, but I have so limited
it's
time
not,
to watch television.
I've not reached very many people, I'm afraid, here.
Tell me a little bit about the process of writing and how you as an author sits down before a keyboard and turns out something. What goes through your mind and how does it work?
Well, let us take it for granted that I have begun. All right, I have begun a novel. I am in perhaps chapter 3. And I know what I'm going to write, roughly. I have a pretty good idea. Part of it worked out into actual prose in my head and some of it glossed over, but it's there. So I sit down at a word processor, but with lots of bits of paper and pen, and I write it on in longhand, and then I put it onto the word processor and have a look at it. And so do I work. And then I will go through it and edit it and possibly frequently rewrite it on the screen. I don't know if this is an unusual way of working, but it's the way I work. And then I work like that. I work in the mornings, and I work every day, provided I'm not haven't got something else. But I wouldn't not do it unless I was doing something to do with my work. I mean, if I was going to some literary function, or I was going to do some radio or television thing, I might not do it. But if I'm home in the morning, I'm working.
It must take an enormous amount of discipline. I have to come to work every day here at CBS, and I get a paycheck every Thursday, and I have deadlines. I have headlines to write, and I have interviews to do, appointments, and this sort of thing. It's a very prescribed way of life. But you, as an author, there's nobody standing behind you saying, Ruth, get back at that word processor. What? It must take an enormous discipline for someone to sit in an isolated room and work all by him or herself.
Well, surely only if they don't like it. I mean, I like it. I like doing it. I like doing it probably better than anything else I can think of doing except reading. I've been doing it for a long time, and things become habitual. They become routine, don't they? I might almost say that I wouldn't know what to do in the mornings if I didn't write. I really wouldn't. It would be very odd to me. It's different when I'm away from home, or it's a Sunday or something. But on those weekdays, I'm writing.
It never becomes tedious or dull?
Well, no, I don't think it becomes dull. No, I don't think that would ever happen. I can't imagine that it would be dull, no. I like doing it, you see. It isn't routine for me. It's not it's not a chore, because I try to make every book different. I mean, I do not. I suppose if I wrote to a formula, I might find it dull, but I never have done that.
It must give you an enormous satisfaction. You have published 41 books. To look at these as what, as your children?
No, I never think about them. I only think about the next one.
You never go back and reread any of your material?
I might have to for the Wexfords, because although the television company that makes them for television keeps a complete dossier of Wexford, they know exactly what I don't. So although I think I hold it fairly well in my head, I wouldn't dare rely on it. So I might reread a Wexford, but I wouldn't otherwise read. No, I don't even think about those books unless somebody mentions them to me. I think about what I will be doing next.
Is there a chronology with the Wexford? Has it become older?
No, he doesn't become older. He doesn't grow old. He's immortal. And it's rather strange, because other people sort of grow older. And of course, there's no doubt that the contemporary scene is very, very current. It's absolutely, I try to make it an absolute picture of life in that sort of country town today, as I did when I first wrote it, but he is much the same age.
That's Markham.
King's Markham.
King's Markham.
In the television series, it's Romsey in Hampshire. And they think of themselves as King's Markham now, I think, that little town. But in fact, it's King's Markham in Sussex, which doesn't exist, which I invented it.
Well, Ruth Rinder, we're just about out of time. I did have one last question for people who read your books and love them and probably aspire to being writers themselves. Do you have any kind of advice for someone who would like to sit down and write a book?
See, I don't think people need advice. I mean, I'm always being asked for it. But you'll find that the people who really want to write, they're writing, they're busily writing. They don't need me to tell them to write. They know how to do it already.
Well, they could use some nudging.
I don't think they could use some nudging. I think perhaps they could use some encouragement. But I know that it is very difficult, and that people fall by the wayside. But I also know that if you really want to write, you can't help it, and you go on writing, and I'm sure that's what they'll do.
Well, you have many fans in the United States, Ruth Rendell, and I know that if they haven't read Going Wrong, which was published in September, but it's still available, and most of your material is out of paperback, too. I mean, I've seen that, so, I mean, there's... I would imagine the bulk of your material is still in print in this country, so it's there, and people who haven't read Going Wrong are going to like it. Ruth Rendell, thank you very, very much.